Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
From the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Americans are worried about their veterans. A 2012 report by the Veterans Health Administration gave us the much-discussed estimate that 22 former service members die every day of suicide, triggered by depression, PTSD, and other mental health problems. The suicide rate prompted an executive order increasing staffing of the Veterans Telephone and Text Crisis Line by 50% and helped secure the passage of the Clay Hunt Suicide Prevention Act, named for a 28-year-old Texas Marine who took his own life in 2011. Ideally, all veterans would have timely access to care that might prevent mental health crises, a goal that has proved challenging in places where VA service providers and facilities have been overwhelmed by rising numbers of patients. Joining us to talk about mental and social services for veterans, we have two guests. Dr. Harold Cudler is Chief Consultant for Mental Health Services at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Michael Fisher is Program Analyst for the Readjustment Counseling Service at the VA. You can learn more about what they do at va.gov. Gentlemen, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
How does the rate of veteran suicides compare with the rate of suicide in the general population?
Well, actually, the rate of suicide is an epidemic for all Americans, and it's been rising significantly for all Americans for the last several years. When it comes to veterans, it is higher than the base rate for Americans. And if we break it down into male and female veterans, veterans of different ages, there are very different rates, so it could be an extremely long answer. But the bottom line is, on the whole, veterans probably kill themselves at about twice the rate of the average American. And this is true not just for veterans returning from war, but for all veterans, those who have served in all eras and in peacetime as well. And there are probably a number of factors that feed into it, and we can talk more about those.
That's an important point to make, that not all of the recent suicides are associated with service in Iraq and Afghanistan.
In fact, a recent study looking at veterans who have served in Iraq and Afghanistan and other veterans showed that if you kind of factor out all the factors that seem to lead to suicide or predict suicide, serving during deployment is actually not one of them. And there's this idea that a lot of us have, and it's very natural, that, well, they went to war and they come back and what else could happen, but their lives will go downhill and this terrible things will happen. In fact, that's not the greatest predictor. Stronger predictors would be, do they have a job? Do they have a home to come back to? Is their family together? Have they lost a spouse or run into trouble with their parents or become homeless? Those are stronger predictors than did they serve in a combat area.
Is there something particularly, maybe the word is not risky, but in terms of mental health, does leaving the service and transitioning back to civilian life present a problem for more veterans than people might realize?
You know, that's actually an interesting question. And I think that it's unique to the individual. And it's really about, you know, it can run a spectrum of things. It can be, what do I do now that I'm not in the military? Do I go to school? Do I use my benefits? How do I access those benefits? All the way to the other side of the spectrum, which is I've experienced some major war trauma. And I'm having concerns and issues from that. And then everything in between. So it's really, it's unique, I think, to the individual.
The Clay Hunt Suicide Prevention Act was signed into law a couple of months ago. What do you see as the most significant changes in it with regard to the access our veterans have to mental health care and social services?
Well, there are eight different provisions to the Clay Hunt Act. The parts that I find really innovative that I'm really looking forward to working on and we are working on are getting peer counselors to help with the transition from the military into VA and into civilian life. You know, as military people often point out, when you enter the military, you are trained by experts and they know exactly how to train you and you become what they need you to be. But nobody trains you to come home. There are talks, but people can't listen. All they want is to go home and be with their family. And if you'll excuse the expression that some military people use, beer, sex, and pizza. And they don't keep those flyers, and they don't register all those things that, oh, yes, you can do these things. We need more transition, and it needs to be stretched out over a longer period of time so people have time to listen and see how these ideas really do connect with the way their lives are going. And one of the best things about the Clay Hunt Act is that it's going to have a pilot program where we'll hire peers, people who have had the same lived experience as people who have served in Iraq and Afghanistan coming home now, who will help direct them, and not just to medical programs, because you can't medicalize coming home from a war. We tend to say, well, they all have PTSD, and they don't. Most of them will never have PTSD. But those that have medical issues, we'll help them with. But those, just about everybody and all their families are going through significant stress, financial, growing pains, kids that have changed a lot since they left and now have different ways of connecting with them. Your job isn't going the way you thought it would when you came back home. Maybe your spouse is leaving you or has left you. These are the issues that we can help with, and the Clay Hunt Act gives us some opportunities to try to help in new ways.
You know, I'd like to add on to that, and Harold, I think that's exactly right. And for us, it's about aggressively going out and finding those individuals and making those face-to-face connections. And, you know, you put it succinctly when you said that vet-to-vet, and that's something we're able to do within our program, the Vet Center program, which actually 72% of our staff are veterans, and the majority of those are combat veterans. It's that instant credibility when, you know, I know what that individual is talking about because I've experienced the same things myself. I smelt the same smells, listened to the same music, if you will, and are really able to make that connection and say, you know what, it's going to be okay. This we've transitioned as well, and we're going to get through this together. And aggressively going out there, and it's something I refer to as the 15 call rule, and that is you have to hear something 15 times before it sinks in, and you're able to repeat it back. So it's going out and creating those face to face connections over and over and over again, and getting them into services with the sole point of getting them to access those services.
Our producers were out on the National Mall this week, and they came across a group of people demonstrating to raise awareness about veteran mental health and veteran suicide. They heard in one case from Chuck Cohn, whose son Tyler, a Marine, committed suicide last year after 4 combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, they say he suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. I don't call it that. I call it moral injury. It's a similar affliction, but it's closely related. Maybe they're the exact same. I don't know for sure. But he knew right from wrong, and he was ordered to do some things that he knew were wrong, but he followed orders like he was supposed to. And he never could recover from some of the atrocities that he committed over there.
That was Chuck Cohn speaking about his son, Tyler, a Marine who committed suicide last year. My guests this hour are Michael Fisher, program analyst for the Readjustment Counseling Service of the VA, and Dr. Harold Cudler, chief consultant for mental health services. I know that there are independent researchers looking into moral injury. Is it something that the VA acknowledges, believes in, is giving credibility to?
Well, actually, I believe the term moral injury was first put forward by Jonathan Shea, who was a VA psychiatrist. And it's been developed by Brett Litz, who is one of our researchers, but also Bill Nash, who for many years was the senior Navy psychiatrist working with the Marine Corps. And Bill has been a great spokesperson for this. Yes, VA is very much looking through the lens of moral injury. And, you know, first of all, my heart really goes out to Chuck Cohn over the loss of his son. And to lose him over something like this, moral injury, is a special kind of loss, that his son may have seen things or done things that he couldn't live with is a terrible loss. I want to address actually the question he raises. Is it the same as PTSD? In my way of thinking, and I'll try to put this in a very few words and not sound like a psychiatrist when I say this, in my way of thinking, the root of what psychological trauma is when something happens in your life and your world is no longer your world. You are no longer who you thought you were or who you were supposed to be. People around you are not what you thought they were. At least your perspective has changed. I'm not saying the world really changed or you changed or they changed, but your perspective has changed in a fundamental way. And suddenly you're a stranger in your own life. And everything that anybody ever told you that you trusted and relied on, right down to the sun's going to come up tomorrow, you don't believe anymore, and you feel lied to and betrayed. And to this extent, I think when you find yourself either witnessing or taking part in something that later on reflection you say this was wrong and this shouldn't have happened, I think that can be the root of PTSD for some people. Not always. There are many people who develop PTSD from disasters where there isn't so much a moral question, or you could ask big existential questions, but it's not always the same as moral injury. But PTSD can be from moral injury, and I think when it is, that's something that each individual has to find a way to work with, and we try to find ways to work with each individual in their own worldview.
We can put our service members in helmets and flak jackets and tanks to protect their bodies. Is there something that we can do to protect them from the full extent of moral injury?
Well, the military has tried a number of different approaches. Back in World War II, they worked very hard to train people as to why we war. And Frank Capra created a program for both the public and the military to explain this so people understand why they're going to these wars. But once you get to war, big issues probably are less important. People fight wars on a personal basis, and they fight it for their buddies as much as for causes. The military created something called Battle Mind, the Army did, early on in these wars. And Battle Mind had a very clear and, I think, very useful perspective. When you go to war, we train you to go to war. You begin to sleep with one eye open. You begin to jump at the least sound. You begin to be able to respond instantly and with aggression. Well, congratulations. You are a seasoned combat veteran. These are battle skills. And this is why you are alive. This is why your buddy is alive, because you could act this way. And this is why the mission was successful, because you have this now combat edge. However, do not try this at home. I think this was a very helpful perspective, because when people came home and did have these problems, sleeping with one eye open and jumping and responding with aggression whenever startled, people could say, I'm not sick. I've adapted to combat. Now I have to adapt back. And it's not about sickness. It's about, hey, I am adapting. I can adapt again if I can get some help and some coaching and some time. I think that was very valuable. And frankly, it's a perspective I want to see continued.
You know, to add on to that, it's about early intervention as well, getting to these individuals as fast as we possibly can and creating those connections with those individuals and normalizing a lot of these things that are going through. I mean, these are things that make sense in a battlefield, and then helping to decrease their barriers to accessing care and making sure they're getting into care if that's something they want to do, and creating those therapeutic relationships.
So the number of veterans enrolled in the VA system, and some of these are there for strictly physiological issues, but it was 6.8 million in 2002. It's 8.9 million as of 2013. But that's still only less than half, right, of the living veterans we have in this country.
About 22.5 million living veterans in this country, covering all eras. As you say, about almost 9 million currently enrolled. But just because you're enrolled doesn't mean you use services. In any given year, it's probably close to 6.5 million veterans using. And frankly, this math leads to one of the most important things. And this shocked me when I realized it after, you know, over 25 years now, over 30 years in the VA. Wait a minute. When you do that math, most veterans aren't getting their care in the VA. And that's really shocking when you've worked in the VA and you get in there early and you leave there late and you believe we've closed out the waiting room. Everybody seems to be seen. I can go home and feel all the veterans are okay. And then you realize most veterans never even came to the VA to begin with. And then you think, are community providers even identifying the veterans in their practices? Because when you think about it, one in five Americans is either a veteran or a current service member or a very close family member. And are they even asked?
We're speaking this hour about caring for men and women who have served in the U.S. Armed Forces with Michael Fisher, Program Analyst for the Readjustment Counseling Service, and Dr. Harold Cudler, Chief Consultant for Mental Health Services for the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. If you'd like to be part of our conversation on Think in D.C. this week, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think in D.C. on KERA 90.1. We are continuing our week in the nation's capital. Today, we are talking about caring for men and women who have served in the armed forces. We are speaking with Michael Fisher, who is program analyst for the Readjustment Counseling Service, and Dr. Harold Cudler, chief consultant for mental health services at the VA. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. You can also, remember, check out our Tumblr feed. We have that going as of this week, kerathink.tumblr.com. We talked earlier about the importance of coming back and having, say, a job and sort of a sense of purpose even after people leave the service. I wonder if the general public's concern for veterans and the recognition that some veterans are dealing with things like post-traumatic stress causes some employers to think, well, maybe this person is damaged goods when they come back, when in fact they are entirely capable of holding down a job and being really productive. Dr. Cudler.
Well, you know, I'm going to respond with something we learned from the National Vietnam Veteran Readjustment Study, which looked back at Vietnam veterans coming home, and it looked at them in the late 1980s. It found that Vietnam veterans who served in Vietnam, that we have all these stereotypes, these guys, you know, they were scraped up from the streets and they were the poor and they were the uneducated and then they had these terrible lives afterward. In fact, the ones who actually went to Vietnam in the 1980s were better educated, had better paying jobs than people in the military who didn't go to Vietnam or than the average American. And if you look at the people who are serving the military now, these people are outstanding. Yeah, they may run into problems. Some of them may run into problems coming home and some adjustments, and God knows they have a lot of adjustments to make. But on the whole, they are an incredibly good investment. But I think you're right. Unfortunately, there's this stigma and a misunderstanding, which is kind of a romantic idea of veterans, but it does a disservice to veterans and their families.
I think you add to that the heavy usage of the National Guard and reservists for these conflicts, who are already members of their community, established members of their community. So they're coming home and continuing those lives, whatever they might be. And then also the increase in benefits that VA has provided since the start of these conflicts, such as the post 9/11 GI Bill, which is giving access to levels of education that individuals might not have had before.
Mike Fisher, can you talk about exactly what readjustment counseling service, what the service provides and what it means for people with different kinds of needs?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are a program in VA that provides readjustment counseling. We're also known as the Vet Center Program. And we provide those services specifically to anyone that has served in a combat zone or area of hostility, anyone that experiences a military sexual trauma. And then we also provide bereavement counseling for any family member that experiences an active duty death. And we define active duty death by just happening while the individual is on active duty. I use the word everyone because we actually have eligibility to provide services to service members, active duty service members, veterans, those who are in the National Guard or Reserve. It's really about did they serve in that combat zone or area of hostility. We do these services through actually 300 community-based locations. And it's a little bit of the difference in our program when you compare us to some other programs in VA, in that we're not located at VA medical centers. We're in the community, and we actually... it was done that way on purpose. We go back to our founding principles back in the late 70s when VA realized that the Vietnam combat veteran was not using VA services. And I think there was a distrust in VA. So they created our program as something that's away from the medical center, further in the community, to get people comfortable with the idea of accessing services. We're actually staffed by fellow Vietnam combat veterans, so it's that creation of that peer-to-peer model or veteran-to-veteran model. Get the individual in, comfortable with the idea of talking about their experiences, and then accessing other services if that is something that they might be interested in. And we've actually, we still hold true to that tenet today where the majority of our staff are combat veterans. And we have actually 300 locations across the country. We're in every state, the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, Guam, and American Samoa. We actually have 4 locations in the North Texas area.
people talk about sexual violence during active duty, and immediately their thought is female service members. But of course, this happens to men as well. And I wonder about the different needs, maybe different structure of victims, depending on whether they are male or female.
Well, in my particular program, we are finding that it is both male and female who are coming forward and saying that they've experienced military sexual trauma. So it you're absolutely right. It is not just a female-only concern.
Yeah, the problem with stereotypes years ago, someone will remember the tailhook scandals, and this led Congress to say, well, we're going to do something about military sexual trauma, which I think Congress actually came up with that term, with apologies to the military. The fact is that at first this was under women's health and people thought a woman's issue. And then someone decided to ask veterans, male and female. And at the time, I think this was about 10 years ago now, women were 20 times more likely than male veterans to report sexual trauma in the military, harassment or outright assault. But there were 20 times more men in the VA than there were women. So actually the numbers of survivors of sexual trauma were equal, male and female. And we had to redesign our program for the special needs of each, because you can't just put those people together and say, well, you're all sexual trauma survivors. You all get the same treatment.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number if you would like to join us today on Think from Washington, D.C. We have Jody on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Jody.
Hello.
Hi, Jody. Go ahead, please.
Okay. So I was having a question about I was listening to the show. Great information. I was listening, trying to figure out about the veterans that are coming back that want to have, you know, want to get involved with the VA, but were not able to due to a discharge. On my post-deployment leave, when I came back from Iraq in 2008, I got in trouble while I was at home, which basically in regards came down to an OCH discharge, and I've been kind of trying to figure out to go for the past couple of years for that. You know, so what would it be, pretty much the question would be, what would it be for the veterans that don't have a fully honorable discharge, because at OCH, all your benefits are 100% taken away.
Thanks for your call. OTH is other than honorable discharge.
Yeah. Thank you, Jody, for the call. It's a great question, because the vet centers were just re-given the authority to provide services to people with problematic discharges. And what we found out is that people serve honorably in war. And then they come home and they maybe make a mistake. Not right choice, show up to formation late or start doing things, other things like maybe getting into substance abuse. And now they have what we call bad paper, those other than honorable discharges. But it doesn't change the fact that you served honorably in war. So people with those kind of discharges can actually come into a vet center and we can talk about the process of how do we go about upgrading that. There is a process for that and what other services might be available. So my suggestion is actually let's get you connected to a vet center. And if we can collect your contact information, we can get that out to the closest vet center to start those conversations.
One of the mental and physical health problems that some veterans experience is substance abuse and substance addiction. How often do those problems begin when veterans are actually serving actively?
Too often. The substance of choice is going to change with generation and where the battle is and availability. Early on in these wars, it was literally very hard to get alcohol in the combat area. That changed. But the fact is that there's also a long tradition of what the British Royal Marines call deep lager therapy, that there's this sense that, well, let's drink our troubles away and also get closer to each other by drinking together. And by the way, as we get more women in the military, women metabolically they're smaller and they can't absorb the same levels of drinking, making it more problematic and leading to other problems. The fact is that people try to separate these issues, substance abuse, PTSD, moral injury. You can't separate them. You have to treat them all together, and it takes a comprehensive plan. Quite frankly, if you go out into the community, most people have, well, I got a substance abuse program down the street, and I got a PTSD program over here, and then maybe you'll wait on this moral injury thing we plan to build next year. VA does try to create a meaningful integration of all these treatments and build it around the veteran. And I think that's what we need, and we need a lot more of it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to, I think it's Jaffe in Carrollton. Hi, Jaffe.
Hello, hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. Sure. One thing I just wondered when I was listening to your program right here, that when the veteran comes, the first thing they have a lot of problems, but first thing is actually is this economical problem. So the public sector employers are reluctant to hire them, and due to many reasons. So why not make a collaboration and educate the public sector employers also, to educate them what are these people, fellows, which come back from the hostile environment, what they're feeling, and how much room we can give them, or how we can accommodate them. They are educated, they are well disciplined, they are well productive. So that's my thing, that if we educate the public sector, means private employers, so maybe it can be helped out.
Thanks for your call.
Well, Jaffa, you said it beautifully, and in fact, in support of that, there have been and are ongoing partnerships between the Department of Defense, the Department of Veterans Affairs, and the Department of Labor to create jobs programs for veterans. There's also the GI Bill, which has been sort of reamped up for this generation, and it's going to cause remarkable opportunities for veterans that never existed before. This isn't to say it's all going to be easy, because it's not all going to be easy. But there are lots of efforts, and a number of major corporations have stepped up to say, we're going to hire X number of people proportionate to our abilities. And I think we need a lot more of that. We've been working in at a number of levels with employee assistance programs, which many large corporations as well as municipal like school systems have, and trying to educate them about the special needs of service members, veterans, and their families, particularly, as Mike was pointing out, the Guard and Reserve, who are quickly rotating in and out of the job market and are expected to make that transition in 30 days, which is that's a heck of a jump for anybody. So we are doing these things, but we need to do them better.
I think it also highlights the need for community partnership and going out there and meeting these organizations and helping them understand not only what we as VA can provide, but also what are some of the things that we're seeing for individuals coming back, to be able to provide that psychoeducation, if you will, as well as ways to get people into services if that's something that they want to do.
Mike Fisher, when someone shows up at a vet center, are they screened in any way at that vet center for mental health problems if they have gone for services that have to do with something like employment?
Absolutely. So anyone who comes into a vet center will go through a full assessment where we're really trying to understand the whole person. So not only what are their goals for coming into the vet center are, it could be job related, but what was their military experience like? What was their experience like before the military, to try to create that comprehensive plan for help them move forward with whatever their goals may be. That could include connection to the VA Medical Center. You know, one way we describe the vet centers is that if you come into a vet center with a broken foot, we can't fix the broken foot, but we know who does. And it's about that connection, that bidirectional referral process to getting that individual to other services that they could benefit for and also that they've earned through their military service.
Are those referrals exclusively to services within the VA? Or I know there are communities where veterans really, if they want to get timely care, they're going to have to go outside the system.
It can be both for us. And it goes back to that idea of community partnership and really what are the needs of that particular veteran population in that community?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Alyssa on the line in Dallas. Hi, Alyssa.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I really think what you guys do is so important, and I'm actually a veteran from Afghanistan, and I'm wondering what are the schooling and qualifications that people have that work in your readjustment center?
Thanks for your call.
That's actually a great question. And it goes back to, first and foremost, it's that drive, that passion to want to work with veterans and provide services. We have multiple positions within the program. And actually, if I could use myself as an example, I'm the typical person who came into the vet center. And that was, I served first. I was actually in Iraq in 2005, went through my own transition, and then started working as an outreach worker. So it's, I was able to go out and find my fellow veterans and create that one-on-one connection while I was actually working on my master's in social work. So then we go into the actual counseling portion, where those are more, a little bit more technical positions. So it's people with mental health degrees or professions in the various fields.
Dr. Harold Cudlor, have we gotten better at identifying which active duty service people might be at increased risk for coming home and experiencing some kind of mental crisis or mental illness?
Well, we're working on that in a number of ways. You know, I'll tell you, I don't think there's a great science. It's such a big question that there's not great science. But I can tell you that when people come home and don't have a job, when they're underemployed or undereducated, when they've been working in a field where every day everything was important and they performed at a very high level, and they come back and they feel confused and overwhelmed by all the different things going on around them, and finding, on the other hand, none of this seems really important. Where I was important. I can't engage. We often hear from people who go to college on the GI Bill that, well, all right, I'm here, I'm glad I have this benefit, and I'm ready to work hard, but who are these people all around me who are talking about American Idol? Don't they realize, you know, we got to focus, we got to get to work? And then they feel like maybe I don't belong here. Readjustment is such a complex thing, and so we need to meet each individual where they are and help them on the path that they're on. That's a big challenge. And again, you know, as a psychiatrist, I wasn't exactly trained to do that. That's where the partnership of the Vet Center and us and the peer counselors we're going to have will make us a better system. But, you know, the real partner, and this gets back to what Mike was saying about the communities, the real partner is the community, and ultimately the real partner is the veteran. And I think the idea that VA is sitting here like this giant monolith and we're going to take care of you, and then people are disappointed when we don't. The fact is we need to partner with veterans, listen to veterans, and also let veterans lead, because I think they can tell us, you know, what's needed and where it's needed and how it's needed, and our job is to follow them.
We're speaking this hour with Dr. Harold Cudlor, who is Chief Consultant for Mental Health Services for the VA. Also, Michael Fisher, he's Program Analyst for the Readjustment Counseling Service of the VA. We're talking about caring for men and women who have served in the armed forces. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org. If you'd like to see what we're up to on our week in Washington, D.C., you can follow the hashtag ThinkInDC. And get a behind-the-scenes look at the action on our new Tumblr at kerathink.tumblr.com. We'll come back to this conversation in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Summer registration is now open with courses in art, history, literature, and new financial fitness workshops. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
Anybody that served, they deserve their medical care. They deserve mental health care. They deserve their benefits. They shouldn't have to wait months and months and months to get their benefits. There are guys that go in, need treatment, and wait 6 to 8 months to get an appointment to see somebody. And if you have cancer, you can't wait 6 to 8 months. It has to be taken care of. You can sit in the VA in the emergency room longer than a regular emergency room.
That was Gigi, a Navy veteran. Our producers here in Washington, D.C. met on the National Mall. She asked us not to use her last name. We're speaking this hour about caring for veterans with Michael Fisher, Program Analyst for the Readjustment Counseling Service, which runs the vet centers around the country, and Dr. Harold Cudlor, who is Chief Consultant for Mental Health Services for the VA. You hear Gigi's frustration, and many people have been frustrated and concerned that in particular parts of the country, there are very long waits. We've heard about, you know, waits that had been concealed. How long does a veteran who is in need of mental health care have to wait?
All right. Well, let me give the best answer to the question. And I'm thinking about Gigi, and very sorry. You know, obviously she had that experience, and it happens to a lot of veterans. We're trying to make sure that the right care is available at the right time, at the right place, wherever a veteran is, in the terms the veteran needs it. It's a very tall order. even with 150 medical centers and another 800 community outpatient clinics and 300 vet centers, it's a tall order. Our rule of thumb is that in an emergency, we will render even humanitarian care for someone who comes to us and can't prove at that moment they're eligible. If it's an emergency, they will get care, and they will get care immediately. If you're a veteran and are saying, call us up and say, I'd like to get a mental health appointment, our standard at this point is within 30 days you'll have one. But that'll depend on the level of urgency. We'll try to figure that out with you. And if you need to come in that day and be seen, we will see you that day. Do we always succeed? Do we always do as much as we need to that day? Do people always want to come? Do they believe, as Gigi has been through, well, what's the point of trying? I hope people will not give up on trying, and I hope they'll work with us and let us know, like Gigi has, when they're running into trouble, because frankly, every time we hear this, we get another chance to fix it. We will continue to push that any veteran will be seen where they need, when they need, won't be happy till it's done.
What is the situation for veterans who live in rural areas or areas that are far away from any kind of military base or post?
And veterans are twice as likely to be rural as the average American. So, and by the way, rural Americans also kill themselves at twice the base rate, whether they're veterans or not. And there are a number of factors for that, too. We have had the Office of Rural Health was set up just a few years ago, Congress recognizing that veterans were disproportionately rural. And they put out $250 million every year for various projects. And I've been very much involved in some of those projects. They've included outreach efforts, working with congregational leaders in rural communities, because, by the way, you're five times more likely to tell your congregational leader about your readjustment problems than you are to tell a mental health professional. They include outreach of clinical teams and partnerships with local public health departments and education of community providers and electronic websites where community providers can learn about us and learn about how to assess for PTSD and traumatic brain injury, which, believe me, in medical school, and I was trained in medical school in Brooklyn, great training for head injury, believe you me, and I was trained at Yale for residency. I don't think I got one real lecture on traumatic brain injury the way that we'd be trained now. So there's a huge training need. The Rural Health Program is helping get that out.
You know, one of the things that we've been able to do is in conjunction with this idea of outreach, is create a program called the Mobile Vet Center Program, which is actually right now we have 80 vehicles across the country. These are large mobile vehicles with space for confidential counseling inside. We also have access to a satellite system that gives us encrypted access to all VA systems of records. So it's going to these communities that are geographically distant from existing services and through focused outreach, make them aware of these are the services that are available and provide that access to those services.
Let's go back to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372. We have Ariella on the line in Dallas. Hi, Ariella.
Hi, how are you?
Very well,
hello,
thanks.
Dr. Cutler and Michael Fisher.
Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me on. I so appreciate this program, and this is very close to our heart here. So it's a good opportunity. I wanted to just mention Dr. Cutler just actually visited us here at Jewish Family Service. We are a social service agency that's open to the entire general community of all walks of life, all ethnic backgrounds and religions. And we serve people on many levels, from the clinical, where we do work with trauma and PTSD and brain injury and so on. And we also offer career and employment services to veterans and their families. And we have children's services. We do work with schools, etc. I can go on and on. My question here really is, as a community partner, and this is where we see ourselves, and now that so many more veterans and their families are turning to us, through different organizations such as Hope for the Brave, such as Defenders of Freedom, and even the VA, we would love to enhance our services and open our arms to as many families and veterans as possible, because we want to embrace not only the veteran but the entire family and as promptly as we can. How can we work more together to make...
Oh, sorry. Thank you so much, Ariel. I so appreciate it.
Well, again, Ariella pulled together a conference with the University of North Texas Health Science Center back in March to try to create that community focus or community fulcrum, if you will, for response. And I love the fact that it was always about the veteran and the family, because one can't separate these things. You know, I can treat PTSD, I can do some things for traumatic brain injury, but if I could help people who have PTSD and traumatic brain injury get their family to work together, to understand the problems, to learn how to adapt, to have faith in themselves and in each other, and to get through this thing together, I can probably do more than I can with any medicine or any psychotherapy. And that's a focus. The fact that Jewish Family Services of Greater Dallas pulled together the National Guard and major employers and congregational leaders across different groups is the kind of center that every community needs to manage this problem. Many people will go to a group like that and not go to the VA for lots of reasons. And I think that's a great start. We want to make sure that when they need VA, as Mike was saying earlier, they know how to get us and they know what we're good at, and we know them, so we can make this transition seamless.
You know, and that goes back to our point about this idea of community partnership. And this is an idea that we take from Native American culture, and that is it's your community that sends you to war. But it's your community's job to give, when you come home, to give that experience meaning. And that's really what we see these partners as doing, is helping us do that. Let's give everyone that experience meaning and welcome them home in a way that they deserve. What a great point about families as well is that we have to be able to bring the family in as well and make them part of the readjustment. At a vet center, we actually can provide services to families, whoever that veteran or service member defines their family to be. But, you know, we find that the veteran has a better chance of making those goals, of meeting those goals, when the family is involved and understand what's going on.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Larry on the line in Denton. Hello, Larry.
Oh, how are we doing?
Very well, thanks.
I am a veteran, 4 years in the 70s, OTH as well. You mentioned earlier about catastrophic. I had more difficulty as far as with my PTSD in survival of a catastrophic of the second Mississippi flood, and I have found it very difficult to find anyone in the medical field that really has done any good as far as PTSD is concerned.
Where would you suggest that a veteran like Larry turn for services if he has an OTH, once again, an OTH discharge?
You know, and I go back to the statement before about the other than honorable discharges. Let's walk into a vet center and let's see what's going on and what services are available and where we can go with that.
You know, Larry, this is a week when a lot of people are remembering the fall of Saigon in 1975. And I think people now may have more options to work with you than they had before. But I also want to point out you're making a great point. You live through war and then a disaster happens later and things come forward. We're now seeing the graying of the Vietnam generation. And apologies, Larry, I'm that age myself. We're seeing the graying of that generation, and I think we're going to see what we saw with the World War II and Korean War generation, which is as they get older, as their social support systems, their spouses die, their children move away, they retire and no longer have a focus in life because they often wrap themselves around their work, partly to defocus from these memories and other issues in their lives. These problems can come forward again, and disaster later in life can bring them forward. And we have to think about how to work with the Vietnam generation to make sure that they can really enjoy their senior years and not be pulled back in their memories because nobody understands. And in all these years, they've never come up with a place to work on these problems and talk about them. And the Vietnam generation is side by side now, dead even, with the OEF-OIF generation in VA. We're equally concerned about them.
Is there parity in the VA for mental health and physiological health?
There has been for many years.
So,
more unique that way.
Yeah, I was going to ask, because so many times people in the general population who need mental health services say, well, my insurance company will pay for a month of inpatient care or something, and then that's it. That is not the case with the VA?
Not the case with the VA. There really is no limit. Actually, that's one reason why 30-something years ago I decided to work for VA, because I never wanted to have one of those phone calls with an insurance company again. And I knew that that wouldn't happen in the VA. In fact, there is absolutely no cap, and there's a full range of services. And in fact, we've invented many of the services that exist that other people use. So I'm very proud of our group, but I also know that when someone can't find their way to those services, and especially when they feel that those services aren't being made available to them, they're hurt in a very intimate way. So the VA has a very important role, and we got to get it right.
Michael Fisher, can you talk about what peer counseling actually looks like? I think people hear that term, and it sounds a little bit loose, maybe. Can you explain how a peer counseling session would play out?
Sure. I'm gonna have to answer that in the terms of the Vet Center program. Mm-hmm. So for us, peer counseling means something just a little bit different. And that is, first and foremost, peer. It's that veteran-to-veteran connection, which we're able to do because a larger percent of us are veterans. But then we're also mental health professionals. So it's that ability to create that instant credibility that, okay, you know what I've experienced because you've probably have experienced it as well, which aids in the creation of that therapeutic relationship. And then once we have that relationship, then we can start providing those mental health services or that counseling services with a trusting relationship.
So it's not just a matter of someone who came back and their regular job is accounting or whatever. These are people who are mental health professionals and veterans who are providing
exactly.
these services.
Now, within our program, we also have individuals who are just veterans. So I look at our outreach staff. Who are fellow veterans, and their purpose is to go out and help other veterans understand what services are available, and then to help them access those services. So decrease those barriers to care. So that could be in line with other definitions of this idea of peer counseling.
In the recent past, there's become a national certification program and training programs at colleges all across America to become a peer support specialist. And we really want more people to take those courses. We've hired, last count a couple of weeks ago, it was like 973 of them in VA, and they're all over the country, and we need a lot more of them. People can take these courses, but make sure it's certified with the national certification.
Is the reputation of the VA and the services it provides an issue for military recruitment in this country?
That is something that I don't know how to answer that question. I don't think I can. I don't know, to be honest with you.
Certainly, I think when people volunteer to serve their country, they should have a good sense that their country is going to be behind them, in just the way that Mike was talking about before. And I think we're always going to be held account for that, and we should be.
And resources have grown in the past few years. I mean, how close do you feel the agency is to having everything it needs to serve veterans effectively?
Well, resources have grown, and as you pointed out at the very beginning of the show, the number of people coming for help has also grown. Mm-hmm. We have a whole generation of combat veterans we didn't have before, and they're young people with a different set of needs. We've had to retool, and we've had to develop a prospective approach to PTSD. By that, I mean in 2001, we could say, well, all right, we've got all these PTSD programs. We've got the best PTSD programs in the world. We can sit back and wait for those people to come and find us. But 2001, September 11th, oh, my gosh, we've got to build a program for the people who are going to go to war. And we have been busy doing that ever since.
Dr. Harold Cudlor is Chief Consultant for Mental Health Services at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Michael Fisher is Program Analyst for the Readjustment Counseling Service at the VA. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Our think team in Washington includes Stephen Becker, Jeff Whittington, and we also want to thank all the people from NPR who've made this week possible. Back in Dallas, the show is engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can find our Tumblr, kerathink.tumblr.com. I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.